This episode is brought to you by Amazon Logistics. The Delivery Service Partner Program is a new opportunity for business leaders who want to own and operate their own package delivery business. Get access to Amazon's logistics training and technology and start building a team of motivated drivers in your community. To learn more about becoming an Amazon Delivery Service Partner, go to logistics.amazon.com.
Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain podcast. I am your host, Radu Palamariu, Managing Director of Elcott Global. Our mission is to connect the supply chain ecosystem by bringing forward the most interesting leaders in the industry. And it's my pleasure to have with us today Alex Capri. Alex is a Senior Fellow and Lecturer at the National University of Singapore Business School, and also he is teaching at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy. He was a former partner and regional leader for KPMG's International Trade and Customs Practice in Asia Pacific. He brings 20 years of experience in value chains, logistics, and global trade management, both as an academic as well as a professional consultant, and has advised many of the world's best-known companies on cross-border projects in more than 40 countries. He also writes for a variety of publications, including Forbes Asia and the Nikkei Asian Review, and is a frequent guest on global television and radio networks, including BBC, Bloomberg, CNBC, and Channel News Asia. Alex, thanks for taking the time. Happy to have you with us today.
Good to be here.
So maybe let's start by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself, about your story and how you ended up doing 40 years in global trade consulting and consulting in general as a career.
Well, for me, the theme of globalization began very, very early in life. I grew up in 9 different countries. My father was with the U.S. State Department. He was a career diplomat, which meant that the family moved every couple of years on average. So we bounced around. And so for me, I became very much acclimated to a global environment. So when it was time for me to go to school, to go to college, university, I was drawn, of course, to international affairs, international relations, which is what I studied. Political economy, international political economy. And then I ended up, my first real job was with the Customs Service, with U.S. Customs, doing work around free trade agreements and customs valuation and so forth. So it just basically took off from there.
Awesome. It's fascinating. I've had a few other speakers on the podcast, and it's interesting that there seems to be a trend of people living in different parts of the world that end up eventually in supply chain or transportation or logistics or trade. So I think there's a common thread in there.
Makes sense.
Topic of the day, a topic of the moment as we are recording this podcast. The world is facing a coronavirus outbreak, one of the worst in the last 20 years, I think, after SARS. Tell us a little bit, how do you see this virus's impact on trade, global supply chains, and what's happening overall?
Well, I think the impact has been immediate. We're already seeing the cancellation of non-essential travel to Asia. I've been speaking with people at companies in the United States, in Europe, in Australia, and companies are already canceling travel. So that's an immediate impact. That means that a lot of the public events that were scheduled are being postponed. I've already experienced that for events coming up later this month. The ripple effect of that, of course, is going to have an immediate impact on local economies, regional economies. If businesses are actually shutting down or closing because of this, then obviously, we're going to have a very, very, very deep impact. So, it remains to be seen how extensive this impact is going to be. I know that the World Health Organization today declared this a public health emergency. It's early days, but there clearly is and will be a financial impact on, not only supply chains, but also financial markets, local economies, et cetera.
I was reading that from a supply chain perspective, obviously there's a lot of airlines that have cancelled trips and flights altogether to China. Obviously that will impact the cargo movements because air freight is probably going to be deeply impacted, and with that the ports will be overcrowded, and the shipments out of China, I think, will be quite a bit delayed. So it's for now in the global trend, since the Chinese New Year is just finishing, I think that there's still to be seen, because it's usually a quiet period this week. But I think next week onwards, it's going to be very interesting to to watch how it's going to progress.
Absolutely. And if you think about the high tech sector in particular, where most of that very, very high value, very small, lightweight items are flown around the world multiple times in the value chains. And if you start seeing a constriction of air travel and air cargo, that's going to have an immediate impact on global value chains in that regard, yeah. Mm.
Kind of putting the emphasis on trade, and we've seen a lot in 2019, and there's been endless debates and discussions, trade wars, trade discussions. Eventually, they concluded with the phase one trade deal between US and China. Tell us a little bit about your views on that deal. There's a lot of people that said it's a good start, but there's, you know, some fundamental flaws also in the framework of the deal. How do you see that shaping the year, this year, and trade in general?
I think the phase one deal is more of a truce. It is, you know, it's a positive sign that the two sides will continue talking and hopefully come up with a more substantive phase two, which will address the core issues, which I'm skeptical of, by the way. Which you know, the core issues being, IP transfer, subsidies to state-owned enterprises, and subsidies to special military civilian fusion initiatives and so forth by the Chinese government. This is core to their model, to their state-centric model. So I just really don't see that changing, substantively. But it is on a very short-term basis positive. But the issue for this decade and beyond, for the whole world, regarding the U.S.-China relationship, is that it is a rivalry. It is a systemic power rivalry, which is much more extensive than just trade and tariffs. And we are seeing this playing out, particularly in what I would call techno-nationalism. This focus by the Chinese government, and now increasingly the U.S. and the West in general, of promoting their own interests when it comes to technology, because it's directly linked to national security, to economic prosperity, and even social stability, right? So I think the techno-nationalist component will manifest itself more and more in this bilateral relationship.
Mm. And I know that that you also recently published a very comprehensive report, and we will share this with the listeners as well, because I think it's something that is of great value. I'd love to go a little bit deeper in this topic on the rise of techno-nationalist industrial policies. Maybe do you have some examples? I think there's been a few, case studies also of China trying to acquire certain companies, or especially the semiconductor industry. There's some pretty large connotations there.
Yeah, so I mean, look, Chinese industrial policy has been a fixture of their system now for decades. And if you look at how China, I would argue, despite the large body of economists and economic thinking that say that, any kind of nationalist, state-centric, subsidy-driven system is going to be less efficient, it's not going to be transparent, it's going to be corrupt, et cetera, et cetera. The laissez-faire system will produce a much better result in the long run. In general, I think that argument is true. But if you look at China, look at what they've been doing in the last 15 years with high-speed rail. Because of their policy, they've been able to attract top-flight talent and intellectual property and investment and absorb that. They've been able to go abroad and acquire that technology. They've been able to develop human capital around that. So you've got the high-speed rail network. You've also got the Beidou basically the navigation satellite system that the Chinese developed, because they didn't want to be dependent on the U.S. GPS system, for example. And then, of course, you can take Huawei. You know, now Huawei is the world's largest telecommunications equipment company, and you know they very quietly carved out a monopoly, very famously now in the 5G network area, because everybody had essentially just outsourced everything to the point to where you know they were able to scale very successfully, invest enormously in research and development, and again, Huawei has been a direct beneficiary of funding, special subsidies from the Chinese government, particularly when it comes to bidding for international contracts. If you flip that over on the other side and you look at what the West has been doing with industrial policy, we're in the early days because, again, the laissez-faire model, the so-called Washington consensus, where you basically government stays the hell out of the way, and you know, basically lets business do their thing. That perception is now starting to change when it comes to direct competition with China in a techno-nationalist sphere. So you have, for example, the United States, the Trump administration, reaching out to Ericsson and Nokia and actually offering to pay them, to subsidize them in a sense, to be able to fund their activities so that they can compete on a price level with Huawei in bidding contracts, and also you know, pump money into their R&D. So that's happening. You also have the European Union. You know, you have very influential voices in the European Union and you know throughout the EU arguing that the US and the EU now need to start forming essentially a joint venture when it comes to setting standards in these industries of the future, whether it's 5G, whether it's surveillance technology. So we're going to see more and more of that. And I would also expect to see new alliances of companies forming, sort of public-private partnerships where governments will incentivize companies to, you know, to begin to work together. And so we are seeing that.
And wanted to also pick your brains a little bit in terms of what do you think China will do as sustained efforts to move away from a dependency on the American technology and in the American supply chain driven semicon and microchips. What do you see happening?
Yeah. So clearly. The Huawei scenario, as we've seen it, you know, with the U.S. placing Huawei, you know, on the restricted entity list, attempting to block the implementation of Huawei around the world, has really brought into really stark high contrast the Chinese need to decouple from American technology, to wean itself off its dependence on American technology. And so this is what I would describe as the de-Americanization of supply chains, that we will see Huawei and other Chinese tech firms very, very aggressively doing and pursuing the strategy of de-Americanization. And so, again, this is going to lead to more restructuring of supply chains, second sourcing or attempts to second source things that were originally sourced from American firms, or at least firms that had U.S. export controls attached to their technology. So that, I think, certainly is going to play out. And that's going to be significant because that means that American firms are going to, as I said earlier, are going to move operations and to try and circumvent those export controls, because obviously they don't want to have to lose market access. But we saw this play out. I mean, it was remarkable what Huawei did with the P30 Mate smartphone. There was a fair amount of U.S. technology embedded in that phone, including the Android operating system from, you know, Alphabet Google. And they managed to, at least the claim is that they've essentially replaced all of that, you know, in a de-Americanization process. which, by the way, impacts everybody in the supply chain, right? Because that means that other first, second, third tier suppliers, service providers are going to have to think about how they may end up having to realign themselves in these new ecosystems. Now, they can do that with smartphone technology, with coming back to the semiconductor theme. You know, the Chinese could be a decade plus away from being able to produce critical semiconductor technology, perhaps even further away, depending on how quickly the state of the art advances and the leaders are able to advance that.
Mm. Wanted also to ask you, you mentioned a very interesting point about the Galapagos syndrome and about ring fencing companies in your report. Maybe tell us a little bit about that in the context of what we just discussed.
Right. So when we were discussing how value chains are responding to these new techno-nationalist pressures by ring fencing off, essentially, operating in insulated environments because of non-tariff measure and other policies. What that does is it isolates national or regional ecosystems in such a way to where you think of the island archipelago of the Galapagos. They have a unique ecosystem that evolved in its own certain way and wasn't able or doesn't adapt well to the introduction of so-called invasive outside species, right? So if you replicate that kind of ecosystem in a technology environment, chances are you're going to get standards that are put in place for technology, whether it's telephone, 5G standards or other types of standards that may be limited to that one region or that one area. That means that those companies that adapt those standards, they're not going to be well suited to compete globally, where there might be more universal or more broad standards. And I think a good example of that is if you look at Japan, you go back a few decades and you look at NEC, which absolutely dominated the telephone market, right, in Japan. But then when you had for example, the adoption of the Android operating system in smartphones around the world, where basically that became the de facto operating system for smartphones, you had NEC operating on a completely different standard. You don't see, they went out of business, right? You don't see them anywhere. In fact, now the invasive species that came into Japan are these other international brands that are operating on this more universal standardized platform. So we could see the Galapagos syndrome playing out around the world in the tech sector as you get, the techno-nationalist pressures forcing different standards. We could very well see that in 5G networks, for example, where you have, Europe, the U.S. perhaps, adopting a particular standard for 5G, and then Huawei having their own standard, and you could have a block of countries or markets that end up going with the Huawei standard. But again, you wouldn't have the whole world on the same standard. So that again, I think that just steers us back into this direction of where I think we're going in the next decade plus, and that is globalization, as we discussed.
And building upon the 5G and the examples that you mentioned of what's happening with Huawei and Nokia and Ericsson and different countries coming together to help this dispute, it's also deeply connected to the semiconductor industry. It's also deeply connected to the IP side of things. So I know you talked about it in your report. I think there were a couple of tried acquisitions by the Chinese government into some companies to acquire some of this IP. Maybe let's go a little bit deeper on that as well.
Right. So semiconductors are at the very, very heart of all the industries of the future. Everything requires a semiconductor, a microchip, if you will. And the state of the art of those semiconductors they're now pushing up against the boundary of Moore's law, right? So, you're looking at 7-nanometer chips. One nanometer is a billionth of a meter, just to put things into perspective, all right? So the technology behind that is critical. And so it is invaluable. Whoever controls that technology is going to have the upper hand in this so-called techno-nationalist world. So, of course, semiconductors are very, very important to policymakers in Beijing, particularly since Beijing, as you saw from the report and the data in the report, that the U.S. companies and non-Chinese companies, but U.S. companies in particular, South Korean companies, absolutely dominate the semiconductor landscape. Chinese companies are multiple generations behind in terms of ability to produce in commercial quantities for this insatiable appetite within the Chinese market. It's the largest market in the world, and yet Chinese companies are producing just around or just below 5% of the microchips in the world, and they're not state-of-the-art, basically. So it's an imperative, particularly for the Communist Party, to be able to develop that industry as quickly as possible. So they've had a very, very aggressive two-pronged approach to making that happen. One is, as I mentioned earlier, it's attracting the investment. It's getting the IP, obviously the technology, the human capital to come to China and establish a presence. But the other element of it is to go abroad and to try and acquire that technology or try and acquire ready-made companies already, if possible. And what we've seen really starting in about 2015 is a really rapid and a ramping up, if you will, of the blockage of those kinds of acquisitions. In other words, in the United States, you have CFIUS, which is the committee that essentially reviews any attempts to acquire U.S. Sensitive industries, i.e. semiconductors. They're all being blocked. So essentially, even in Europe, we're seeing examples. So we saw, for example, the Germans, they blocked the Yantai Taihai Group, which is a Chinese investment group with state-backed funding, in their attempt to buy the Layfield Metal Spinning Company, which is a very, very high-tech industrial spinning technology company. And that was on the grounds of national security. You know, if you look at in the semiconductor space, we had the Fairchild Semiconductor acquisition in 2016. That was blocked. Again, a Chinese company. That was about a $2.5 billion attempted acquisition. We had the Lattice Semiconductor in 2017. Another Chinese-backed private equity firm, Canyon Bridge Capital Partners, attempted to buy Lattice Semiconductor. That was a $1.3 billion deal, blocked, stone cold. We had Qualcomm in 2018, the attempted acquisition of Qualcomm by Singapore-based Broadcom. The Singapore-based entity of Broadcom. And Broadcom is, of course, an American company, right? So, there's just not a lot of activity in that space anymore, and I would expect any kind of attempt to block, or rather to acquire semiconductor technology in the future by Chinese interests will be blocked.
Hmm. And based on this, and based on this increasing IP linked conflict and interests involved in the chips and semiconductor industries, taking into account, US, Taiwan, Germany, Korea, Japan, chip producers' main market ultimately is China. How do you see things shaping up in the next, 5 to 10 years, given all this underlying national interests?
So the extensive global value chains that have taken essentially 20 to 30 years to develop in the semiconductor space are going to be carved up. We are going to see those value chains fragment, localize, regionalize under this banner of techno-nationalism. So here's an example. Take TSMC, the Taiwanese foundry. This is a company that that produces an inordinate amount of the chips under contract to companies such as NVIDIA and also to Huawei. Anyway, the U.S. government has been pressuring the Taiwanese government, as well as putting pressure directly on TSMC, to move operations and to actually build a plant in the United States to serve specifically U.S. clients because of fears of Chinese espionage, Chinese influence in Taiwan. And so, for example, the F-35 fighter jet actually uses microchips that are produced by TSMC. So at the same time, you have the Chinese Communist Party also putting pressure on TSMC to relocate production into the Chinese mainland. This is really going to play out in the next, you know, 1, 2, 3, 5 years. And I think this is going to be dramatic because the United States has particular influence over over the semiconductor value chain, including TSMC, which produces the vast majority of the subcontracted chips in the world. I mean, it's a huge, huge disproportionate amount that TSMC produces. But the U.S. still has the power to basically put a stranglehold on that value chain because the equipment needed to mass produce those chips is largely U.S. equipment. So you have Applied Materials, you have KLA Tencor, you have Lam Research that make this manufacturing equipment and the tooling equipment that's needed. So there are multiple choke points in that value chain that the U.S. could simply say, look, this is to the Taiwanese, which is what we call a Schedule B country, meaning that a lot of the U.S. control technology doesn't require a license to go to Taiwanese companies. If that were to change, if the United States again decided to cut that off, they could conceivably basically shut down the supply of TSMC chips to Huawei. Now, will there be collateral damage? Absolutely, right? You can start with the American firms that are in fact subcontracting TSMC. That, you know, if it really went nuclear, then they would be impacted. But the U.S. could selectively say, look, we will not issue you. We will make this a licensable transaction if you want to sell to Huawei. And if you do sell to Huawei, we could conceivably put you on the restricted entity list.
Mm.
So it could get really, really complicated. And I think to avoid those kinds of situations, we're going to actually see the ring fencing off of production again in local markets.
Hmm. That's fascinating. I mean, because we've seen a bit of a glimpse into what can happen when Google and the Android took away the Android system from Huawei, or when they announced that the initial sanctions, I can't remember when it was, a couple of months ago, and then Huawei had to, it was kind of a forced move that they had to launch their own Harmony operating system that, yeah, I think now they're trying to more or less put it on all their devices. But it's not as easy to do that from, basically they're years behind in terms of developing the chips.
Right.
At the same time, all these companies, which are mostly American and Taiwanese, the size of their market in China is huge. So if they just cut off the supplies to China, it's going to hurt their business. So it's...
Absolutely. That's the collateral damage I was referring to. And it would be massive. I mean, if you look at a company like a Broadcom, or you look at other companies, NVIDIA, you know, Global Foundries, obviously companies like Intel. Now, Intel is a vertically integrated company, so they would be able to perhaps absorb this type of scenario a little bit more easily, but all of these companies have major business that they're doing in China. And so to have that kind of value chain or those value chains disrupted is absolutely going to create havoc, basically. You know, they're going to lose market share. And really a scenario like that where you had the U.S. government really using the nuclear option, if you will, that would have serious ramifications just on the global economy. I mean, really, it would be profound because remember, from everything from smartphones to television sets to a whole array of other kinds of gadgets and appliances, they all require microchips. So if that essential supply chain, it's a bit like oil, right? If you cut off the oil supply, what that does to the global economy, I mean, the damage inflicted on the global economy through a very poorly thought out kind of tech war, if you will, through the indiscriminate use of sanctions and putting people on the so-called specially designated nationals list, which means that basically U.S. companies and U.S. citizens cannot trade with those entities, period. That could have just catastrophic effects on the tech landscape and also the global economy.
Hmm. How about from a skill set perspective and from a human capital perspective? Because also what has happened in these years, I guess also China tried to develop and to attract and develop scientists and engineers and the, like you were mentioning, the that pool of brain power to take them forward. How do you see this shaping up in terms of the future? Because there's also going to be certain countries, maybe U.S., will try to limit or try to do something also in that respect.
Yeah, again, here we have an example of collaborative networks that have developed over decades where there's been the relatively free flow of ideas, human capital, obviously. You've had these partnerships that have involved, the world's top universities, these big companies, government initiatives, etc. We are now, as part of this new landscape, we're now looking at a situation where the free flow of human capital or the exchange of ideas, it could also be severely curtailed or limited. A controlled technology or a so-called deemed export of that technology could it actually involve an email being sent to a foreign national that's restricted or a foreign company that's restricted. So that could really put quite a crimp in some of these research and development projects that are going on. Who can participate? Is there an academic that is perhaps potentially on an SDN list or something? What does that do to the whole program if there's a violation? Well, the whole program gets shut down. The university gets is violating an international export control law and could be penalized, etc. So that means that we're also going to see this fracturing of these value chains when it comes to human capital. So we'll have the development of these pools of talent, and there will be competition to get that talent. And let's go back to Taiwan. So, Taiwan, of course, has, as I mentioned earlier, TSMC, they have UMC, et cetera. These are companies that have a lot of engineers, very, very well-educated, sort of leading-edge engineers. The university system in Taiwan is also producing. They're doing a pretty good job of producing engineers. A lot of them have also studied abroad. They go back to Taiwan. Chinese semiconductor firms, SMIC, for example, of course, companies like HiSilicon, which is owned by Huawei. They are offering huge amounts of money and incentives to try and attract this kind of talent over. And this has become a national security issue for the Taiwanese government. They actually have in the offices of TSMC and the other, you know, high profile tech companies in Taiwan, the Taiwanese government actually has offices with officials sitting in those offices, ensuring on a day-to-day basis that national security secrets are not being pilfered or leaked from those companies. We will just see more of that. And again, in cases where either the technology or even the human capital is deemed to be highly sensitive, we will see attempts to remove those elements and ring fence them somewhere else. So again, all of this is going to profoundly impact global value chains.
And thinking from the business side, if we think from a CEO perspective, from a chief supply chain officer perspective, with all these uncertainties, all this trade wars and trade discussions and tensions between the superpowers, what type of advice you would give to them? I mean, what should they be thinking about? How can they be preparing, if at all, for such things?
So I would say that prepare to become a global company, meaning you might be a global company, you're a multinational company, but you will have to focus more and more on local environments, local operations, local supply chains. And that isn't the most efficient of scenarios. That means that some of the economies of scale that your company may have enjoyed, i.e. in terms of the free movement of goods, people, ideas, and increasingly data, that's something we haven't really talked about yet, but that's another element that is increasingly facing impediments and increasingly having to deal with local regulations and local environments. Overall, what it means is that that companies need to become more adept at becoming effective global players by going local. In other words, what the term that's been used is glocalization, right? A global company that is increasingly local in more and more locations.
Because it's interesting that, I mean, we've had all these years of globalization where the reverse was happening, right? Where I don't know if the reverse, but a lot of companies were running all these global supply chains, and they tried to either have regional points or even sometimes they were highly centralized in a couple of locations. And now it kind of turns on its head, that model, and forces them to rethink it.
Yeah. Part of this localization process means that companies are going to have to restructure their supply chains. And that restructuring, if we stay with this example of technology and even, you know, controlled technologies, sensitive technologies, industries of the future, right, which increasingly are going to require licenses and will be subject to other kinds of controls. One of the things that we see playing out in the semiconductor field, for example, but other tech sectors as well, is companies are restructuring their value add operations. In other words, they're moving things around so that they can meet certain thresholds of what we call de minimis, for example. So in the case of the U.S., U.S. has de minimis levels of, for example, 25% or 10% of certain types of U.S. technology, meaning when you manufacture something abroad that has U.S. technology in it, if it exceeds the 25% level or the 10% level, depending on what it is, it's going to require a license depending on who you send it to, who the buyer is, where it's going. That's quite an onerous thing to have to manage, because you have to have full traceability in your supply chain. You have to know where the parts came from, what their values were, etc. And it also, of course, puts a company in a position where if they, you know, need to apply for a license, it could be rejected. Now, licenses are, to be honest, are not rejected very often, but it's still
a way to control it. It
ups the level of uncertainty, and it also adds costs because you need to have the resources to to affect, you know, the traceability and the transparency that you need in your supply chain. And that's not easy to do when you've got thousands and thousands of parts and components, many of them moving around multiple times across borders, right? That's a big responsibility. So how do you mitigate as a company? Well, what you do is you try to get below those de minimis levels so that there no longer is a license that's required. So that means, you know, ironically, a lot of these export controls, which were in terms of, you know, the rationale by policymakers, were set up to protect U.S. industry. But in fact, what's happening is they're having to move abroad because they, you know, given a choice between losing market share, hard-earned market share, or complying with this regulation, staying, you know, keeping operations exactly as they were, and potentially losing that business in the long term anyway, they obviously want to protect their market share. So they're offshoring, they're moving stuff around, they're moving stuff out of the U.S. In terms of these operations. So that's another component of localization, right? The restructuring of these value chains in such a way to be able to circumvent legally, totally legally, right? To be able to circumvent some of these very onerous requirements that we're seeing in these non-tariff measures, mm-hmm. such as export controls.
Mm-hmm. This question just popped into my mind. Would you have, from the advisory and consulting work that you do, would you have an example or some case studies of companies that you've seen in recent periods, I mean, I don't know, 12 to 24 months, I guess 12 months is intensified, that have done this fairly well, like from moving this or adopting this global type of a mindset?
Well, again, you know, this is going to depend on how capital intensive this activity is. But, you know, there are, you know, certainly a lot of examples of companies that are doing, for example, in some cases they're doing testing, in some cases they're doing you know, some other work, perhaps even in the you know, the combination of components and subcomponents that aren't necessarily that complex, but there are labor costs involved, there are overhead costs involved that, you know, when you factor in these differences, either the costs are less or they're more, depending on what they're trying to achieve. That's a fairly common activity, right? In terms of, can you shift something from one country to the next and attribute the labor to that country as opposed to, you know, country A as opposed to country B, and or, you know, certain assembly operations, fairly common.
Got it. Alex, it's been fascinating. Thanks for the sharing. Thanks for the case studies. Very interesting to see how this all plays out. Thanks for joining us. And as shared, we will make available with our audience the report. And I do strongly advise and recommend it to everybody to read, because it's quite insightful. Thank you once again.
Thank you very much, Radu.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to go to www.elcottglobal.com and click the podcast button for all the show notes of the interview. Also, subscribe to our mailing list to get our latest updates first. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, we would appreciate a kind review. 5-star works best to keep us going and our production team happy. And of course, share it with your friends. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me. And if you have any suggestions on what to do and who to invite next, don't hesitate to drop me a note. And if you're looking to hire top executives in supply chain or transform your business, of course, contact us as well to find out how we can help.